tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday, the 3rd of March, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, today I want to talk a little bit about Winston Churchill, and this is because his statue was vandalised last week. People may have seen the footage of it. It was apparently done by people who support Palestine. And in large letters, it had spray painted onto the statue, Zionist War Criminal. Now, this was carried out by people on the left, and of course, we don't support vandalism in any way, shape, or form. But the sentiments there, I would say that nationalists should agree with that sentiment there, because that is what Winston Churchill was. He was a Zionist, and he was also a war criminal. And I'm actually seeing the left wing becoming closer and closer to a lot of the things that we believe on the right as ethno-nationalists, particularly because of what's happening with Israel and this, even this attack on Iran as well. It must be so plain for everybody to see how much Jewish power there is in the world, how much influence they have over the American and the British government, and how much influence they have over the mainstream media. It really could not be more obvious who it is that is really responsible for this attack on Iran. I think even the American military men are aware of this. Before the battle cruiser actually got there into the sea opposite Iran, the sailors were stuffing socks down the toilets, trying to flood the vessel, I should imagine, because they didn't want to go and fight for Israel. They don't want to lay down their lives at all, but they wouldn't mind laying down their lives for America. But I think they can quite clearly see that what they're doing here is just laying down their lives for Israel. It's got nothing to do with making America great again, and all about doing Israel's bidding. So I think this idea that the Jews don't actually have any influence at all and they're this poor, persecuted minority, I think people on the left are beginning to see that that is no longer the truth. And as I say, this attack on Winston Churchill's statue, I think this is evidence of this. A statue of Winston Churchill in Westminster was vandalised by pro-Palestine protesters. Graffiti was sprayed on the statue of the former Prime Minister with the words "Stop the genocide and free Palestine." And they don't include it here, but the biggest one that you could see was calling him a Zionist war criminal. The bronze statue of Sir Winston was unveiled just metres away from the Houses of Parliament in 1973. Other graffiti read "Never again is now," "Globalise the Intifada," and "Greetings from The Hague" in Dutch. Of course, Globalise the Intifada, that has now been banned. That is now classed as a terrorist statement. And really, it just means globalise the resistance. But because it is used by people who support Palestine Action and people that have carried out terrorist acts, the British government are now saying that to use that term is... it shows support for terrorism. And of course, I'm just using this term because I'm quoting it from this GB News article, not because I support any idea of intifada. Reacting to the news, Deputy Chair of the Conservatives, Matt Vickers, told GB News, "It is disgusting and vile. Whoever is doing this needs to be held to account. When we were in office, we brought forward legislation to help tackle this. This is an attack on democracy. This is an attack on this country, its culture, and its history. Well, as I said, I don't agree with the vandalism, but to say that Churchill is a war criminal, a Zionist war criminal, surely that is a part of democracy. You should be able to make these statements. You should be able to say these things, and you should be able to have a conversation about them with people. You shouldn't have to just agree with the mainstream narrative. A democracy implies that there would be a plurality of voices, a plurality of ideas, and the best ideas are supposed to rise to the top. And the weakest ideas that don't have much evidence to back them up, then they are supposed to get destroyed in the public debate, basically. But what they say here is, when somebody refers to Winston Churchill as a Zionist war criminal, which is true, they call it an attack on democracy. Interesting that they don't actually debate the facts, whether it was actually true or not. Now, we have a series at Radio Albion called Churchill's Body Count, and this is part of the Truthful Out radio series that I made with Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II. Now, Dennis started making a fourth series that was called Churchill's Body Count, and he got the scripts together, he got some of the footage together, and we started discussing this in audio format as he was preparing the new series. And unfortunately, he became ill, and also he ended up wiping the whole series from his hard drive, so we never actually got to see the videos that he'd started making. But we do have the audio version of it, and if we have a look at that, we can see just some of the things that Churchill actually did. Now, he's held up to be this wonderful hero of Britain, but in actual fact, he is nothing of the sort. If it wasn't for Churchill, Britain would still have its British Empire. Britain was so in debt at the end of the war that we ended up losing our entire empire. Churchill destroyed Britain, pretty much. He destroyed most of Europe, and yet he is held up to be a hero. And this is because it wasn't actually the British people that won the war. It wasn't the European people that won the war. You can see it wasn't that the Europeans that won the war. When you look at VE Day, which is called Victory in Europe Day, not a victory for Europe, a victory in Europe. It was not a victory for the Europeans. And the people that win the wars, they get to make the history, which is why Churchill has been made out to be this great hero. Let's have a look at what we have written down here about Churchill's body count. The first part deals with Churchill's deliberate plot to entice the Germans to sink the Lusitania and thereby bring America into the war. Churchill armed neutral merchant ships and ordered them to attack U-boats, in the hopes that this would cause the maximum loss of life, as U-boats would have to torpedo the ships instead of surfacing and allowing the passengers to get into lifeboats first. So the shipping was supposed to be neutral, and all the while that it was neutral, then it wouldn't be attacked during the war. But Churchill sneakily started arming these ships that were supposed to be neutral and gave them orders that they should attack any Germans that they would see. And of course, as it says here, these Germans that were in their submarines or their U-boats, they would have to torpedo the ships, whereas because they could end up being fired upon themselves otherwise. Whereas normally what would happen is that they would surface and allow the passengers to get into the lifeboats first if they were going to fire on a ship. He then started arming the passenger ships, including the Lusitania, which also happened to be laden with illegal ammunition. And I believe a warning was actually put in the newspapers, the American newspapers, saying don't get onto these vessels because we know that they're being filled up with arms and munitions to fight in this war. And if you get on this vessel, then you might become a target. But the Americans said, "Oh no, that's quite safe. You can get in here." And Churchill withheld the British intelligence that warned of a U-boat in that vicinity and just sat back as his plan worked, and 1,000 innocent passengers were blown up by the Germans. And after this, he tried to get the captain of the Lusitania blamed for the catastrophe. And as we say here, Winston Churchill is no hero. He was a dishonourable fraud who should have been tried for his war crimes. That's just one of them. Another episode we have here about the Russians. Many Russians fought alongside the National Socialists against the Soviet Union, and at the end of the war, they were removed to Britain. There, they were held in camps before being sent back to Stalin, but many started committing suicide rather than be sent back to their homelands to face a certain death. Churchill was the man at the top, responsible for sending 2 million of these brave men to their fate. So Russians that fought against the Soviets, fought against the takeover of their country, at the end of the war, they were just sent back to the communists to certain death, basically. It came to Britain where they claimed asylum, they wanted protection, but Britain said, well, you don't need protection because you don't need protecting from our allies. And so he sent 2 million of them to their certain death. We can look back a little bit earlier at Churchill's behaviour. This is an episode looking at Churchill's behaviour around the world in the different countries that he was posted in. He began by burning villages and poisoning wells in Afghanistan before coming back to Britain and sending lawless thugs into Ireland called the Black and Tans. Imagine that, poisoning wells and burning villages. I believe he gassed a group of people as well. I think he gassed maybe the Kuwaitis, maybe the Iraqis. After that, he went back to the Middle East and graduated to bombing villages from the skies in Iraq. And remember, this is in the early 1900s. There's no anti-aircraft missiles. They were just sitting ducks. He helped topple the democratically elected leader of Iran and promoted the Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia that became the teachings of ISIS. And that's particularly prescient today when we look at what's happening in Iran. Of course, the Iranians didn't want to have puppets ruling them. They wanted to be ruling themselves, which is why they got rid of these puppets. It's quite interesting to see that Churchill was responsible for putting one of the first puppets in power. Even Churchill's allies, the Greek partisans, were mowed down by Churchill's troops under his own orders at the end of the war. So he wasn't averse to stabbing people in the back. Next up, we have a look at Churchill's relation with the Jews and the influence that Winston had on the formation of the State of Israel. Remember that what was graffitied onto this statue is that Churchill was a Zionist war criminal. So far we've been looking at the war criminal accusation. Now we'll look at the Zionist accusation. Churchill was around Jews from birth, and it seems he felt closer to them than he did to the British, and we use quotes in the programme to point that out. Many times he stood for them in direct opposition to British interests, fighting to beat bills in Parliament that would have limited Britain's involvement in Palestine. Remember, the reason why Israel is in Palestine is because during World War One and the Balfour Declaration, and a representative of the Zionist Federation of America came to meet with Lord Balfour and said to Lord Balfour, we can guarantee that we will bring the Americans into the war to fight on your side if you will promise to give us Palestine as a homeland at the end of the war. And that's what Lord Balfour did. He signed the declaration, a declaration of intent, that at the end of the war, because Palestine would be left to Britain to manage, that they would give it to the Jews to set themselves up a homeland there. And of course, the Zionist Federation did bring the Americans into the war, and Britain and America defeated Germany. Up until that point, it looked like Germany was going to win the war. So they picked their moment when it looked like Germany was going to win the war, and they said to Britain, if you do this for us, we'll bring America in on your side during the war and you'll win the war. So that actually took place before Churchill. But then after that, there were these various bills in Parliament that would have limited Britain's involvement in this. And he supported the Zionist ideals. Thanks in no small part to him, the Zionist project reached fruition and his best friend and mentor, Chaim Weizmann, became its first president. So that's how close he was to the head of Zionism. It was his best friend and it was his mentor. That was who he learnt from. So he learned everything from this Zionist mentor. So he was quite clearly a Zionist. Let's go back to the First World War now and discuss Churchill's disastrous leadership of the Navy in 1915 that led to the worst defeat in all of British military history. By the end of 1914, Europe was bogged down in trench warfare and Churchill was itching for the British Navy to see action. Instead of taking time to prepare a proper plan, he talked the British government into allowing him to try and open up a route to get supplies to Russia through the states of the Dardanelles. And I think that's near the area near where Crimea is. It's near Turkey, the bit where Turkey joins Europe. The operation was a total disaster and ended with a combined European army and navy dug into trenches, unable to even get up the beach after landing on it, whilst being picked off by Turkish guns above. The ground was rocky and they were not even able to bury the dead, leading to polluted water and rampant disease amongst those left alive. You imagine those conditions that they were in. 150,000 men ended up dead or wounded, securing a territory with no strategic importance before the troops finally withdrew and Churchill was removed from public life in shame. 150,000 men died because of him in horrendous conditions, starving and surrounded by the dead bodies of their friends. And you can say, well, that's not really a war crime, but it's a terrible decision that he made. It just shows you and how somebody that could make such a terrible decision as that could then be held up as a hero today really shows you that we're not being told the truth today. Next up, we have the Blyberg massacre, where Churchill sent thousands of Croat men, women and children to certain death at the hands of Tito. After the war, thousands of Croats went to the British to surrender and claim a refugee status. But instead, they were tricked into entering trains that would take them back to Soviet Slovenia. When they arrived, they were murdered in cruel and horrific ways, such as by concreting them into mines to suffocate them to death. And Churchill knew that this was going on. It was quite clearly a war crime to send refugees back to certain death, to be tortured to death. And it did not gain public exposure until the 80s, when a Croatian filmmaker with an American accent interviewed the British Army personnel who carried out the orders. And they said they could hear the machine guns. They knew that the Croats were desperate not to get on these trains, and they had to force them on there with their guns, knowing that when the train ended at the other end, they were just going to be murdered. And you can see that this army officer was racked with guilt over having to do this. And it's not as if Churchill didn't know what was going to happen to these Croatians. And of course, Dennis Wise himself, he's half Croatian. His father was one of these Croatian refugees, and he actually managed to make his way over the mountains and into Britain, where he claimed asylum. So he managed to avoid this. But his friends and relatives, they were massacred in this attack. It's one of the reasons why Dennis felt inspired to tell the other side of the story of what happened during the war in his excellent documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told. Next, we have Winston Churchill's cowardly and unnecessary attack in Algiers on his allies, the French Navy. And I'm sure the French are still unhappy with Britain for what happened here to this day. A man who cannot be trusted will seldom trust anyone else, and Churchill was no exception to this. The admiral of the French fleet had given his word to Churchill that if Hitler ever tried to take over the French fleet, his men would scuttle their ships. And of course, this happened after France capitulated to Germany. And there was an armistice, and there would be no more fighting between the French and the Germans, and the French would be occupied to prevent Britain from making its way through France to attack Germany. So there's no more war. The French fleet itself is in Africa. And the Admiral has said to Churchill, it's all organised. If one German tries to set foot on these ships, we will sink the ships. Expecting his word to be enough, Admiral Darlan was then shocked to find Churchill offering him ultimatums and threats before then blasting the French Navy while they were sitting ducks in the dock at Algiers. I don't know how many French sailors were on those ships. Must have been over 1,000, probably a lot more than that, to be honest. And they were just murdered by Churchill, just destroyed their ships. Later in the war, when Hitler did try to take the rest of the French Navy, the Navy that wasn't docked in Algiers, the sailors dutifully scuttled their ships, proving that their word would have been honoured. Thanks to Churchill, over 1,000 French sailors needlessly lost their lives, more losses than any that Germany had suffered at that time. And that's an incredible thing to think there, that the Germans didn't actually die, and Churchill just killed a load of French sailors rather than hurting Germany. He ended up hurting France. And that also sort of shows you how the Germans were trying to avoid avoid deaths, basically, a minimum amount of casualties, and also the French. But Churchill just really didn't care about the number of casualties that he caused. I mean, one instance that we can really see this in is the Bengal famine and Churchill's role in starving 4 million Indians to death. Nearly a tenth of Bengal's population were starved to death during the war. And Churchill ensured that there was a complete press blackout on this, so the British people didn't know that this was going on. According to the archives, he deliberately prevented any aid being sent to India when the famine started, instead diverting it to Europe. And don't forget, all the grain that had actually been harvested in India was taken out of India and sent to Europe. Two reasons are suggested for this. One, he wanted supplies for future use by Europe. And two, but he also wanted to punish India for wanting to leave the empire. But the end result, whatever the motive was, the end result was that a tenth of the population starved because he took the grain from them for future supplies, not supplies that were needed now for Europe, but supplies in case they were needed later on for Europe. So you can really see that Churchill was no heroic person. He should not be put forward as a hero of the British people. We haven't included in this the fact that he lost the British Empire because he spent all our money on this absolutely pointless war against our German brothers. The British people were told that Germany was about to invade Britain and wanted to take over Britain and we'd all be speaking German. Well, the actual fact was that Hitler had a lot of respect for the British and for the British Empire. The last thing he wanted to do was go to war against his brothers. All he wanted was that the Germans would stop being persecuted in Danzig. He wanted to build a railway line from Germany to Danzig, because Danzig was a part of Germany in the First World War. After the First World War, they had the Versailles Treaty. And at the end of the Versailles Treaty, the media would tell you that nobody was satisfied with the end result of the Versailles Treaty. I mean, one of the contested points of it was that areas that had been German for centuries were now no longer German, and they were to be managed by other organisations. So you had Slovakia, Bohemia, you had Danzig that was in Poland, and it was sort of separated from Germany by Poland. And the people that were in Danzig were being mistreated by the Germans, rather the same as the people in the Donbass region were being mistreated by the Ukrainians. So the people in Danzig were not being allowed to speak German. They were being beaten up, they were being attacked, horrific things were done to them, and there were large refugees from Danzig that were flowing into Germany. And essentially the Poles wanted to take Danzig for themselves. And Hitler said, well, we've got a solution to this. We want to build a railway line to Danzig, and we want to have free trade between Danzig and Germany. And the plans for that were all going very well with the Polish representative. And then the Polish representative died and another representative took over. And during this time, Churchill, or Britain rather, had gone to Poland and written them a blank check, essentially, and said that if you get Germany to go to war against you, we will come in on your side. So they were always encouraging them to provoke war with Germany. Hitler said, look, this problem with Danzig is coming to a head. We need to have a talk about this. We need to all get together and talk about this. We want Britain to be the mediator. We want a representative of Poland. We'll have a representative of Germany. And this needs to be done by this date at this time. And Britain said, don't go to the polls. And of course, it came to that date and that time. The deadline was passed. And then you had the Blitzkrieg, and Germany went into Danzig, and they secured the German people that were in Danzig, and they also secured the rest of Poland so that the Polish could not attack the Danzig people anymore. And after that, Britain declared war on Germany, and in order to prevent Britain from being able to get in and surround Germany, which had happened in the First World War, Britain surrounded Germany and then starved Germany, essentially, at the end of the war. So to prevent that happening again, Hitler went into France. And after he had secured France, and after he had allowed all the British military to get back on boats and go all the way back to Britain, after he was triumphant like that, he offered to go back to where he was in Germany, everything back how it was, and we'll now stop the war. And Churchill refused. And I think there are about 20 different attempts that Hitler made to stop the war and go back to how things were. So Hitler certainly didn't want to invade Britain and have everybody speak in German, but that is what the British people were told. In actual fact, the reason for all of this was because of what they did with the banks. They got rid of the Jewish banks, essentially, the central bank, the internationalized banking system, and they set up a barter system with other countries in which they would swap the goods that Germany made for the goods that they needed from these other countries. They got rid of usury from their banking system. They issued their own promissory notes based on labor that the German government guaranteed what they would be worth. And you had this massive boost to the economy. And you had, I think it's 6 million Germans went back to work who were unemployed up until that point. So you had what was called the economic miracle. And because of this, obviously the bankers were not happy with Hitler. The other thing that he did was he retired all the Jews that were politicians or that were in important roles in government. He said, why should we have Jews making these decisions for Germans? We want Germans making these decisions. So all these Jews were given pensions, they were paid off, and they were removed from their positions. And that annoyed international Jewry. And of course, international Jewry has a lot of connections with the banks as well. So the changes to the banking system also annoyed international Jewry. And as we have pointed out, Churchill was an ardent Zionist. His mentor was Chaim Weizmann. And Churchill was always surrounded by Jews. There was even a point in his life when he owed so much money, he was going to lose Blenheim House, I think it's called, this great mansion that he lived in. And a Jewish organization bailed him out. I think they were called the Focus Organization or something like that. David Irving has done this research if you want to find out the details on that. They bailed him out, and of course, then he owed the Jews. And I believe that they called that favor in and said, do whatever you can to go to war against Germany. And of course, then we ended up with this war against Germany. Moving back to the article on the graffiti on the statue of Winston Churchill. A Met police spokesman said shortly after 4 a.m. on Friday, February 27th, a man was seen spraying graffiti on the statue of Winston Churchill in Parliament Square. The first officers were on the scene within 2 minutes. The man, who is 38, was arrested on suspicion of racially aggravated criminal damage. He remains in custody. That's interesting, isn't it? Racially aggravated. They are basically equating a dislike of Zionism with racism. So they're saying that people that are against the political ideology of Zionism are actually racist, but you're protected. Your political ideals are protected under law. You can have a belief. You can have a political belief. Surely that means that you could also be against somebody else's political belief, and that would be protected in law. Yet it seems that the police don't see it that way, and that this is a racially aggravated criminal damage, even though it's clearly against Zionism, not against the Jewish ethnicity. In an updated statement, it was revealed that the man has been further arrested on suspicion of supporting Palestine Action, which is a proscribed organisation under the Terrorism Act, and he remains in custody. So they remanded him as well. They just stuck him in jail straight away for this. So Winston was a strong supporter of Zionism, having campaigned to withdraw British forces from Palestine and allow the birth of a Jewish state in the area. So they're pretty much admitting that Churchill was a Zionist, and yet this man that wrote Zionist War Criminal on the statue has been accused of racially aggravated criminal damage. When Churchill returned as Prime Minister in 1951, he pivoted foreign policy in the Middle East in a more pro-Israel direction. Shortly before his retirement in 1955, he told the Israeli ambassador, in the latter's paraphrase, that he was, quote, happy that future generations would thereby know that the sons of the prophets dwelling in Zion were among his many well-wishers from all over the world, close quote. And of course, they're not the sons of the prophets at all. Their ancestry doesn't actually go back to the Israelites. Their ancestry goes back to the Edomites, the Canaanite Edomites, which anybody can learn that just by looking up Wikipedia on Edom, Esau, Edom, or you can go and have a look in Flavius Josephus, the histories of Flavius Josephus. It was very, very well recorded that by the time of Jesus, the sons of Esau, who were Canaanites because his wives were Canaanite wives, they were essentially running the whole establishment in Judea for the Americans. And they are the ancestors of today's modern Jews, the people that were actually descended from Judah, the Judahites and the Benjaminites. They became Christians and they left. The prophecy was that Jerusalem would be destroyed, so they left. And the Canaanite Jews that were left there, that clearly were not Christian, they weren't a part of Christianity. Christ did not come for Canaanite Jews. He came for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And the end result of that was that the temple was destroyed, Jerusalem was destroyed, and the people that were there fled. They eventually got banned from returning to Judea, and they eventually made their way over to the Khazars and interbred with them, and then made their way into Europe, and then made their way into Israel. And these people do not go back to the prophets of the Old Testament. They go back to the Canaanites of the Old Testament. And anyone who knows their Bible will know that the Canaanites are the designated enemy in the Old Testament. And it's just that by the time of the New Testament, that same people, the Canaanites, were then referred to as the Jews. But that's really another topic for another podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.